From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Does gender determine where you ride a bike?
Women in particular are more averse to traffic turbulence, let's call it. And we're willing to go out of our way to get a quieter street, slower street, even if it means we add a little bit of extra distance to our commute.
We'll hear from Salita Reynolds in our series about identity in design, and we'll ask if a bro culture should affect the planning of bicycle lanes. First up, though, immigration from Mexico has yet again been in the news because of a so-called caravan of Central Americans trying to come north. President Trump has tweeted that Mexico has done nothing to stop the asylum seekers. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions has sent his own caravan of judges and attorneys to the southern border to prosecute border crossers. He visited the border himself yesterday.
We're here to send a message to the world that we are not going to let the country be overwhelmed. People are not going to caravan or otherwise stampede our border. We need legality and integrity in our immigration system.
Now, Sessions may fear a stampede, but right now there's a reverse flow as well.
It seems that more people, especially on the American side, are like hungrier to support cross-border things and go over the border as almost like an FU to Trump. Or like, for whatever it is, it seems like it has pressurized the community to be like, oh, Tijuana's right there. Like, more San Diegans, especially creative youth, are mindful of that and supporting artists on the other side of the border more.
That's Alan Lilienthal. He's a musician based in San Diego and Tijuana, and he came to KCRW's studio with his brother Itamar. Itamar makes furniture and products, and he's also based on both sides of the border.
Each side has its own unique identity and unique skills, you could say. In Tijuana, you have incredibly artistic artisans and just manufacturing jobs that if you're building furniture, if you're building products, you have access to that. In San Diego, you have really good not only funding, but you have just really creative clients and opportunities that come about from the California side. So it was really this idea of using design to not only foster more cross-border collaboration, but through cross-border collaboration, create more sustainable products.
We first met Itamar Lilienthal a few weeks back at a Mexican design pop-up in LA called Nero 48. It took place in a newly finished upscale rental building at Fairfax and San Vicente. You could wander through show apartments where they were showcasing contemporary homewares, art, furniture and fashion from Tijuana and beyond. Elia Hara was a co-curator of the event.
When we create Nero 48, the pop-up store, we was thinking to create something for Tijuana. That's how we started. And then that was very big successful. So people from the country, like for center and south of Mexico, they decided they want to participate in Nero in Tijuana.
Now, Tijuana came into being largely because of its location at the U.S. border. It was a party destination during Prohibition and then later a hub for maquiladoras. 10 years ago, however, things got very bad.
After the economic crisis, because the Lehman Brothers situation, it was like 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. Tijuana was also living very tough situation because the cartel and the mafia.
Oh, the cartels.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So I remember the city was empty, you know. A lot of people who have the capital to invest, they moved to San Diego, to Los Angeles. So they was gone. Everybody was gone. The city downtown, everything was for rent, for sale. It was very dramatic, the situation. But which is funny is that who are the ones and the first ones who would decide to be entrepreneurs, even in a really, really small scale, are the creative industries, right? The artists and the cultural community.
All this started with food culture, and then came stores in emptied-out buildings, and then pop-ups, like Nero 48, where Itamar was selling a cushion called a bombo. For Itamar, the design made of buckwheat hulls and an inflatable air bladder had larger goals than simply to provide seat support.
But the beauty of that is it's all made in what I call Las Californias, and that means that the air bladder itself is made here in L.A., all the fabrics that we use are the dead stock or those surplus fabrics from local upholsters.
And in LA?
In San Diego.
Okay.
And then all the labor itself, all the finishing touches is made, half of it in Chula Vista, which is the south of San Diego, and half of it in Tijuana. Even though I know I could eventually move 100% of the production down to Tijuana to save a couple bucks or to make it more cost effective, I am very much wanting to have it always be made half on this side of the border, half on the other side of the border. Because through that, I feel like the best way that you can influence the politics, the current politics, is through economy. You know, if you can create an economic argument of why we need to have more border flow, more openness in the border, then it happens. Because at the end of the day, like, money inspires politics. Money funds politics.
And money talks, as they say.
Money talks. So it was kind of, how can I create a binational design house that really is based on both sides? So that is our identity.
That's Itamar Lilienthal. Now, some border artists are using paint to express rage at the White House. Take, for example, an artwork on the wall of a charter school in Chula Vista that's gotten lots of media attention.
It's a mural that is now making waves all across the country. Take a look at this. It's President Trump with his head on a spear.
A San Diego muralist named Sasha Andrade painted the image, evoking Mexico's pre-Columbian past with its Aztec warrior spearing the president. And it has ignited a heated and divided response.
I need to take it down. I need to take it down, like, draw something more positive. Maybe I understand that they don't like Trump, but that's not the way to show it.
I feel like it represents, like, a lot, and that it means a lot to the artists who created it. I view this as freedom of speech. I don't think this is something that is going out of the line.
But Ita and his brother Alan Lilienthal hoped to create unity with cushions and music.
So I play in a kind of binational hip-hop supergroup, we call it, called Tu Lengua, with rappers and producers. We are about to release our first mixtape called Baja Funk, which plays right into what Ita is doing with design. We kind of like developing this aesthetic in similar to like the surrealist movement or something like that, you know, developing a visual and musical identity that is cross-border and thrives in spite or because of the border. It becomes almost like strengthened by this idea that two different countries can be united through music.
En el agujero del conejo me caí y no me quejo. Algunos ven al mundo enfermo, yo lo veo como espejo, un reflejo de sueños, ilusiones, no me alejo. Poder en mano mala, poco a poco me emparejo.
It is mostly hip hop. I mean, it's the foundation is hip hop, but we, as hip hop to me is everything, right? Because like hip hop pulls every kind of influence into itself, through sampling or through whatever it is. Hip hop, that's why I think it's the global force it is today. So yeah, hip hop is our guiding principle, but we pull from Latin music and we pull from rock and roll and we play guitar. It is a live band too, so it's not just a DJ dropping the music and us rapping. We are all musicians as well, like musicians being like instrumentalists, I mean.
But to some extent, it is a kind of analog to what's going on in the visual arts in terms of kind of creating a new identity. Is there a kind of a Tijuana voice, you know, that can be found in the products that are coming out of Tijuana now?
I think it's still very young, but I think there is, as more time passes, coming out. That is kind of the whole idea of what I've started calling Baja Funk, like Baja Functional.
Baja Funk, your album that's coming out, and Baja Functional design. That's clever.
So that was kind of the whole idea.
It's very layered.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of meaning, but it was kind of the whole purpose of this is as a way to try to create a narrative with what's happening around Tijuana and just creating a name for it. That's why I started using Baja Funk. So I think so. I think that you are starting to see more of an aesthetic that is the very much Tijuana aesthetic. And how I would describe it is very much in like the Zen California philosophy, like zened out simple design with a more edginess to it that has to be more reused, more repurposed. I think that's kind of what I would describe that. You will see a beautiful, not chandelier, even chandelier actually, that's made out of old beer bottles Or I've been to, there's this really cool restaurant, Telefonica, some of the best food you'll ever have, that in the middle of it, the fireplace is an old, like, huge truck tire that's covered in beer caps, and then the glass itself where they burn it is the beer bottles themselves. So I think that is very much the Tijuanense aesthetic of finding trash but making it beautiful and transforming it to the point that you can't even tell it was trash to begin with.
Can I say something really quick?
Alan?
Yes. It seems to me like that the aesthetic of Tijuana and the aesthetic of San Diego, you could say, is not so much unified by a distinctive aesthetic, like external physical aesthetic.
Language.
Like, I think it's more unified by a psychology.
And an approach.
It's more, the approach and the psychology that's super resourceful, like extremely resourceful, like using whatever you have, waste, trash, whatever it is, to make beautiful things. It's also very resilient and strong-willed. And because Tijuana has been through so much violence, so many political, like, tug-of-war that Tijuana has been in the middle of, that I think there's a big warrior spirit in the young creative class of Tijuana that is, A, hungry to establish itself as way more than its historic reputation as a city of vices and a dirty place. Like, the young people in Tijuana are very, and in San Diego too, are very hungry to show the world that that's not all it is. Like, there's like really some beautiful things happening. So I think that approach of resiliency and resourcefulness and a lot of spirit is more what unifies the art that's coming out of Tijuana than any visual aesthetic.
That was Alan and Itamar Lilienthal, two brothers in San Diego and Tijuana who are making cushions and hip-hop in the name of binational cooperation. I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, has a bro culture shaped the planning of bicycle lanes? We'll talk about identity in design. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Now for another story in our series on identity and design. Last week we heard from Roma Agrawal. She's a structural engineer at AECOM, and she's pushing for more women to join the profession. And she says this is not just for the rewarding job and good salaries, but because diversifying the design teams and clients produces a building or product that meets the needs of a wider range of people. Okay, so what might that mean in reality? Here's a very basic example that Roma mentioned.
I think one example, which probably all of us can relate to, is the fact that women are always standing in line to use the toilets. So somebody somewhere has made some kind of guidance to say, well, this is how many male and female toilets you should have in a building. And clearly, it's just not enough for the women, or the proportions are wrong, or there's something not right about it.
Yep, women can all relate to that one. But how about another field of design, specifically road design?
Women in particular are more averse to traffic turbulence, let's call it. And we're willing to go out of our way to get a quieter street, slower street, even if it means we add a little bit of extra distance to our commute.
That's Salita Reynolds. She is general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. We spoke with her recently about road safety in light of rising numbers of fatal collisions. We discussed the city's use of road diets, in which car lanes are removed to slow traffic and improve pedestrian and cyclist safety, and the backlash that these road diets have incurred in some areas, especially when they impact arterial streets. These major streets were, after all, originally conceived to be wide, straight, and multi-laned to enable cars, buses, and trucks to power down them. And so these arterials can be intimidating to bike on, even when there are clearly painted bike lanes. I confessed this feeling to Salita, and she agreed and added,
there are a whole new wave of designs for people biking and walking that take those preferences into account.
Really?
It's been obvious to anybody who's been looking at who bikes in cities for a long time, at least in the U.S., that men outnumber women on bikes about 3-1 in most cities. You'll get most of the people that you see and that you encounter on bikes in cities are men and are actually, you know, to even refine it further, younger, very fit, potentially more aggressive men. They're actually called strong and fearless, but I don't like that, the use of that word. So fast and fearless. And they're actually a very small percent of the population, maybe 1% to 3%.
Salita Reynolds credits a pair of Portland-based academics, Roger Gallo and Jennifer Dill, for mapping cyclists by type, from the fearless to the fearful.
And in particular, what Jennifer did that was so fascinating is to take a look at where women ride their bikes now. And there are a lot of really amazing female cyclists and, you know, who are comfortable going 30 miles an hour on a street. But what Jennifer found is that a lot of them are willing to go out of their way to get to quieter streets that are lower volume, lower speed, go out of their way to use residential streets rather than staying on the arterial routes. So why? Why wouldn't we just put the network on these streets that are more comfortable, not just for women, but probably for a whole host of folks, children, older adults, casual cyclists? Why wouldn't we just build off-street paths and neighborhood bikeways? And what's in there is a legacy of really two things. One is there was in the 70s and 80s a moment when in the U.S., traffic engineers and others were sort of talking about prohibiting bikes from being on streets. And there was a movement by a group of folks that said, no, we have a right to the streets, and bicyclists can just act like cars. And they don't need any special infrastructure, and they should be out there on the street, and that is the safest way for them to be. And those folks figured out how to sort of infiltrate and influence the committees on major institutions that make the design guidelines, that write the book on how we design bike lanes in the U.S. and in this country. And they were mostly male, and they were mostly sort of in that fast and fearless group of cyclists. And so our rule books for a very long time designed for that user and not for a mom on a bike with a cargo bike in the back with three kids in it. And then the second set of things that really resulted in the designs and the network that we have is the way that transportation funding and financing works. Most of the money that we use to build bike facilities, particularly in California, but in the U.S. as a whole, comes through a frame of emissions reduction. And so in order to demonstrate that your project is worthy, you have to show that you are taking cars off the road and thereby reducing emissions.
And of course, it's from the busy arterials that you get the biggest bang for your buck in terms of reducing cars and emissions. Now, why does this granular level of planning matter? Well, it matters because the larger and more diverse a crowd of bike riders you have on the streets, the more you can build support for safety measures to protect them. So I asked Salita, if she had a choice, would she put the bike lane network on quieter streets in LA?
I feel strongly that particularly from a Vision Zero perspective, from a safety perspective, but also from the perspective of just having a bikeable city and having a city where riding a bike to go get brunch with your family on a Saturday morning is a viable choice, we have to look at neighborhood streets and a neighborhood network. And we actually do have a series of what we call neighborhood greenways that we are designing and building that pivot off of this idea that the arterial streets cannot be the only part of your network.
Now, of course, the question arises, what happens when the side streets stop?
Where the neighborhood greenway network always falls apart is when you have to then swim across the wide river of a fast arterial street. So you're on a nice, quiet neighborhood street, and then all of a sudden you have to cross Beverly Boulevard. And so that means that we need to put in things like, you know, signals and other sort of things that make it easier and more comfortable to get across that route. But that really is, it's sort of block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood, and it takes a very thoughtful approach. But when we have, you know, as many women biking as we do men in LA, then I will know that we have been successful at designing a system that really works for everybody.
You're listening to DNA. We're talking about the role of the designer in helping women feel safe pedaling on city streets. But let's go back in time for a moment to late 19th century Victorian England, when the bicycle was first invented. It was hugely attractive to women who could afford one because it represented freedom. But it wasn't made easy for them. According to the author of a new book called Bikes and Bloomers, quote, onlookers often hurled abuse and stones at female cyclists, while conservative social attitudes meant that it was unacceptable to appear in public wearing trousers. The book was written by Dr. Katrina Jungnickel. She's a sociologist at Goldsmiths College at the University of London.
There are so many ways that women chose to ride their bicycles, because there really was nothing that was going to stop women from cycling. However, there were many social, political, and material barriers that they faced when the craze for cycling in the 1890s really swept through the nation.
And when you say material, are you referring to money, or are you referring to fabric, as in material getting caught up in spokes of bicycle wheels?
We can certainly speak to both, because my research is mostly about middle and upper class women cyclists, because they, in a way, were the first ones to have the opportunity to ride bicycles, have the money to purchase this new leisure technology. So certainly some of that, but definitely there were material restrictions. And I think any contemporary cyclist can kind of just imagine what it might have been like to wear conventional women's fashion from the 1890s, which consisted of a whole range of different styles, of course, but ostensibly was long, full-length skirt, up to 7 pounds of heavy-laid petticoats, tightly laced corsets, tailored blouses, vests, jackets, gloves, veils, and even more. So some women just kept on riding their bicycles like that, but the newspapers were filled with kind of terrible stories of women dying or becoming disfigured as a result of kind of having terrible crashes because their clothing was catching in wheels or getting wrapped around pedals. Others chose to wear what was called rational dress at the time.
Did you say rational dress?
Rational dress. Yes.
Which was what?
There was a rational dress movement. Dress reformists had been around for the whole century, but was certainly gaining a lot more traction towards the end of the century. So they were advocating for lighter materials, you know, less tightly bound corset or no corset. And with cycling, there was a whole range again of different styles, but ostensibly the kind of extreme end of that was replacing your skirt with a pair of bloomers. But there was another thing that some women did, because some of them were like, we're definitely going to ride our bicycles. And that's when I went into the archives and found radical new forms of patented cycle wear.
Which sound absolutely fantastic. Please tell us about the dresses with pulleys.
Absolutely. Well, there's a whole range of ways that people, and particularly women, invented what they were calling convertible cycle wear. So one of them, with the pulley system built into it, was invented by a woman called Alice Louisa Bygrave. She was a dressmaker from Brixton in South London. She patented that garment, which she called Improvements in Ladies' Cycle Wear, in 1895. It has weights sewn into the hem at the front and the back of the skirt. It has stitched channels running up the centre and the rear seams, and wax cord threaded from the weights in the hem through these stitch channels up to the waistband. They are threaded up through some buttonholes that don't have buttons involved, but they're just concealed at the waistband. And then the cords would be tucked inside. So you'd have no idea that this was such a garment that would convert into anything else until the wearer got close to her bicycle, would pull the cords out from the waist and then pull them up, much like a curtain. We were calling it a skirtin in the studio, which might give you a better sense.
Brilliant. So really a piece of engineering, but still a lot of fabric there. It's not like wearing leggings. I mean, you're still wearing an abundance of clothing to ride a bike.
Absolutely. I mean, really, it seems cumbersome to our contemporary sensibilities. But at the time, it would have been much lighter, much more mobile than conventional fashions at the time, and kind of created, you know, a space for women to, and an imaginary to, you know, actually engage with, you know, the cycling world that otherwise they may not have had a chance to do. And yet they're also laying claim to these, you know, in a public way through patenting. So I think these really bring to light women's engagement and contributions as inventors and engineers and as designers.
What a brilliant story. And just again, it's so easy, particularly in the US, to think of the vehicle of freedom being the car and to forget just how much the bicycle, when it was invented and first appeared, represented freedom in just the same way.
Absolutely.
That was Kat Young-Nicol. Her new book is called Bikes and Bloomers, Victorian Women Inventors and Their Extraordinary Cyclewear. We should add that Kat didn't just do the research. She and a team made the outfits from old patterns and actually tested them out. Thankfully, women don't have to deal with pulleys and bloomers anymore. But clothing can still be a deterrent to women who want to ride bikes. At least that's the experience of Nona Varnado. She's an educator and activist around cycling in LA, and she spent a few years designing bicycle wear for women.
I'm very, very familiar with the history. And, you know, in my own small way, I've really appreciated to be part of that continuum. And it's still going on, you know. One of the main questions that I have from people, from women who want to be cycle commuters, is like, you know, they either want to go on a date or they want to get to the office looking lovely. You know, a lot of women don't want to have to modify what they're wearing. If you talk to guys, they're like, oh, I'll just wear those pants or shorts, it's fine. it's a very simple conversation. But, you know, with women, it's a more in-depth conversation. And I think that that is actually usually quite promising, because then like all of these other things get to come out, and you have also the opportunity to really forge a more meaningful connection or conversation.
That was Nona Varnado, and that meaningful conversation can be about learning to ride safely and finding a place in a growing community of cyclists. But that community, some women say, is dominated by a bro culture. Back to Salita Reynolds with the LADOT, I asked her about this notion of a bro culture.
So I think that cycling culture in the U.S. has long been dominated by a culture that maybe you could describe it as bro culture. I think that may be not exactly right, but it is a very muscular male culture for sure. It is about, you know, how fast your time is on Strava. It is about bike messenger culture. That's really what it grew out of. And then there are, you know, there's racing culture and mountain biking culture, which are all have a very sort of male-dominated flavor to them. And when I've gone on rides with men, what I notice is that there isn't necessarily the attentiveness to the concerns that women would have. So I think there's a real challenge if we ever want to normalize cycling, that we have to break that kind of very tribal mentality.
Reynolds says normalizing cycling is vital if we're to get communities to rally around safety improvements and not push back against them. In other countries, she says, biking is so normal, it's just another mode of transit. That's not the case in the US yet.
You know, if you ask somebody in another country where there's a lot of biking, if they think of themselves as a cyclist, they will look at you like you are speaking a different language. You know, that would be like saying, you know, you brush your teeth every morning. Are you an oral hygienist, toothist, right? No, it's just something I do. It's just how I get around. And I drive and I walk and I take taxis and I get on the bus. And it's one of my choices. Here in the U.S., it's very tribal. And if you're not in the tribe, it can feel very alienating. And since the tribe is mostly made up of men right now, I think it is hard for women to feel comfortable. And that's why you see a lot of intentional work by some of the best bike advocacy groups in the country around women-only rides, around how to get women into cycling. There's great work happening, but there's, I think, a pretty long way to go.
You've been listening to Salita Reynolds. She is General Manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. And that's it for today's DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at KCRWDNA. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.